Welcome to the Orlando North Church Podcast. Through this podcast, we hope you'll be both encouraged and challenged as you hear what God is speaking to you. Orlando North is called to go and be Christ's church to the world through the Holy Spirit by connecting people to God and to each other for His glory. More details about our church will be available at the end of this podcast. Now, enjoy this week's episode.
Hey everybody, this is Pastor Rob, and I am coming to you in a different scenario than normal. I am in my office right now, and I am going to just kind of teach through the notes of what I shared on Sunday. So you won't hear crowd noise, you won't hear the hysterical response of all the jokes that I told, which was just crazy. I'm kidding, of course, but I want to go through this thing with you and talk through this so everybody will be up to speed, everybody will know what's going on, and hopefully this will encourage some people, because I really felt like as I was going through this and preparing this message, that this was a really personal one. I felt like this was the most important one of the entire At the Movies series. The one thing that you won't get is you won't get the movie clip that we played that day, which is, you're not losing anything by missing that. So allow me to go through this, and I hope you'll enjoy this. I hope it will speak to you, encourage you, whether you're in the car, at work, at home, whatever you're doing. I just really pray that this will encourage you this morning. So I start with this, thought of, do any of us wish that right now we had a DeLorean, a Doc Brown, and a flux capacitor? If you know those terms, you know that they came from the movie Back to the Future. And what I mean by that is, do you wish in your life that you could go back in time to a certain point in time, maybe 10, 15, 25 years ago, where you made a decision that is still impacting your right now? So you made a decision 25 years ago, and the ramifications of that decision are still being felt even today. Anybody that is over 10 years old knows this to be a fact, that the decisions that we make in our present are going to have reverberation. Is reverberation a word? They're going to have ramifications later on in our lives. We also know that decisions that we made in our past also have ramifications in our today, whether they are good or bad. And I want to give a quick example of that, just kind of a funny little illustration to kind of open up this train of thought about how our decisions of today will impact our ramifications in the future. And one of the ways to do this is with a story, and it would make more sense because it's such a mind-blowing story, and I think every single one of us has a story similar to this. And it's a story of how we got to where we are, how Melanie and I are married and have two kids, and we have Orlando North Church, and Orlando North Church next week, a week from Friday, are going on this beach retreat. How did we get to that point? What were the decisions that were made decades ago that ultimately led us to this point where next week we're celebrating together as a church body this incredible beach retreat, which, by the way, I even told everybody on Sunday, beach retreat, we only have, like, I think 5 rooms left. Normally we have extra rooms. This year we only have 5. We have 224 people registered for Beach Retreat. It's by far the biggest retreat we've ever had. So if you want to go to Beach Retreat, you're listening to this, sign up today. Go to OrlandoNorth.com. There's our little commercial in the middle of all this. But how did we get to this point? How did we get to this place? Well, it kind of starts, if you go all the way back to the 60s, where my father-in-law, Gary Hall, even at the beginning of all this, he decided he wanted to go to West Point, the West Point Academy. And he had the grades and all of that stuff for it. And he wanted to go to West Point. Well, one thing led to another. He goes into West Point, graduates from West Point. Then he serves 2 terms in Vietnam. And while he's in his first term at Vietnam, he gets shot up by mortar. He gets a mortar injury in his shoulder. So if you're at Beach Retreat in a couple weeks and you ask him to take his shirt off so you can see his wound, because it's pretty impressive on his back shoulder. And he got injured so severely that he had to go for rehab. So Gary gets blown up in or injured in Vietnam, ends up in Virginia Beach, Virginia, for his rehab assignment. Now, this is where it gets interesting, because while he's there, there's another young lady who lives in Virginia, from Hopewell, Virginia, who is happening to be vacationing at the beach, at Virginia Beach, at this same time. And while Gary's walking on the beach, this young lady named Patsy is also on the beach. And the rumor has it, their joke, this is so funny to this day, if you could have seen their faces on Sunday, it was just extraordinary. The joke is that Gary walks by and Patsy's response is something like, "Hey, big boy," what you doing? And of course, that's not really what happened. Anybody knows Patsy knows that that's not true. But they start talking. They go on a date that night. They fall in love. They get married years later or months later. And then Gary goes and serves another term in Vietnam. They get married after that. And then they come together. They move to California. They now live in Florida. And then they have a baby girl whose name is Melanie. And that would be the woman that I would end up marrying. Now, on the other side of the world, or the other side of the country, up in Michigan, my dad, at 16 years old, so we're talking mid-60s, probably around 1965, I believe. My dad's 16 years old, and he asks a girl out on a date. It's a blind date, and he's been set up on a blind date with a certain girl. The day of this date, now this is crazy, the day of this date, this young lady gets sick. And instead of calling my dad and canceling the date, she calls a friend or a cousin, actually, and asks her to go on the date for her. So she calls in a relief pitcher. It's crazy. Calls in this relief pitcher. The relief pitcher is a 14-year-old cousin of hers, and her name is Gail. And they go out on this date together. And I don't know everything that happened, but my dad's 16 and this young lady's 14. They go on a date. All I know is that they kissed. So everybody listening that knows my mom and dad, they kissed on their first date. Totally grosses me out. But it happened. And so on their first date, my mom wasn't even supposed to be there. She was the backup for her sick cousin. She goes in. My mom and dad fall in love. They get married. And they ultimately have me. So on one part of the country, you have Melanie down here in Florida. And on the other part, the northern part of the country, you've got me. And so we're separated. And now God's got to put all this stuff together, right? So that we can ultimately be married, have kids, start Orlando North, go on this beach retreat next week. So God's starting to assemble all this stuff. And how he's doing it is absolutely crazy, because what's happening down here in Florida is Melanie, as a high school student starting to decide on where she's going to go to college, has the president of Lee College visit her church, speaks at her church, and she's really intrigued about going to this college. And then one of her really close friends ends up going to Lee as well. So ultimately, Melanie decides to go to Lee College. Now, here's what's interesting. Melanie is 2 years younger than me. 1992, when I'm a senior in high school, I get done playing my final tennis match of our tennis season. So my sports are done. The day that I finished, it was the district tournament. I'll never forget it. It was the end of the district tournament. My mom and dad packed me into a car. It sounds like they put me in a trunk, but I sat in the back seat, or I drove or something. But we headed down to Cleveland, Tennessee, because they really wanted me to go to Lee College. I had no interest in going to Lee College. It was a Bible college. I didn't feel like that's where the Lord was guiding me to go. I didn't know what I wanted to do with my life. At that point, it was accounting. I wanted to do accounting. And Lee College didn't serve that purpose at all. But our pastor's daughter had set up and arranged tryout for me with the tennis coach of Lee College at the time. So we went, and just if anything, it was just a road trip, it'd be fun. So we went down to Lee College and met up with the tennis coach, and I tried out. I played a set against some guy that was on the team. I think he was number 3 or number 4 singles at the time. And I played the best tennis of my life that day. I was nervous, played the best tennis of my life that day, and I beat him. And at that moment, I had an opportunity to play college tennis for Lee College. And so with that would come a partial scholarship. It's like Division 7, Division 8 school or something like that. So it's not that impressive, but I had the opportunity to at least get partial scholarship to a liberal arts school that's pretty fairly expensive. But that wasn't what the Lord had for me. That's not what the Lord, I felt the Lord was calling me to. So I turned it down and I rejected it. Now, here's where it's interesting, because in 1992, Melanie was only a sophomore in high school when I was a graduating senior. So we were 2 years apart. Now, where the story gets cool is in 1994, I'm really praying about what the Lord wants me to do with my life. And I felt a strong calling to go into vocational ministry, to become a pastor. In order to do that, I had to go to Lee College. That was our denomination's college. That's the best I knew. It's a college that I was interested in now, but 2 years ago, I wasn't interested in it at all. And I wanted to go to Lee College. So 1994, I end up going to Lee College, and I go, and get this, no longer with a tennis scholarship, because I haven't played in a couple years, and I am now paying full price to go there. But at the same time, there's this incoming freshman from Orlando, Florida, who is now going to Lee College. My suite mate, somebody that I shared a bathroom with in our dorm, was also a freshman. And one night we went to dinner, and he saw somebody at dinner who he had a class with, and her name was Melanie Hall. And so we sat with her, and that night is when I was introduced to Melanie, and the rest is history. Melanie and I go on to get married. Ultimately, we have 2 kids, Haley and Caden. We start this church, and we go to beach retreat. So it all kind of came together like that. Now, when Gary was planning on going to West Point way back in the 60s, he did not have Beach Retreat 2018 in mind. Patsy didn't have it in mind when she went to the beach that day. My parents certainly didn't have it in mind when they went on their first blind date. Yet, God leveraged those decisions, those moments, those important decisions years and years ago to ultimately lead us to where we are today. And the cool thing about that is the decisions that we're making today, whether it's my decisions, Melanie's decisions, my kids' decisions, people in our church, those decisions will now branch out and affect things that are generational in years to come. So the things that we do today will have ramifications in tomorrow. And this goes both ways, doesn't it? Think about this. The decisions we make today will have a ramification or results in tomorrow, whether it's good or bad. It happens with temptation. How many of us can think about the temptations that we gave into decades ago? Like for the first time, we gave into some kind of temptation, and then all of a sudden it became a crutch, or it became an addiction, or the result of it became a scar that will never go away, something that you will never forget, something that still creeps its head up from time to time just to taunt us a little bit. So on that side of the coin, we know that that's true. We wish we could go back 10, 15, 20, maybe 30 years and make a decision differently than what we did, because now we feel the weight of what took place in that moment. So it happens on the bad side, but it also happens on the good side, where when we make decisions, how many people today are doing really well because they invested in Apple stock, you know, 10 years ago when it was selling for really cheap and now it's really expensive. So those decisions go both ways. But my point is, I want us to understand that the decisions that we make will have ramifications later on. And we know that, but we need to think about this through the lens of faith. And this is what this whole sermon series has been about, this topic of faith. And Hebrews chapter 11, verse 1 defines faith as the assurance of things hoped for, the conviction of things unseen. This isn't just wishing upon a star and hoping that something might happen. Faith is the conviction or the assurance. I know that I know that I know that this thing that has not yet happened, or this thing that I cannot yet see, will one day take place. It's more real to me than the reality in front of me. This truth of God's promise, this truth of God's word, the truth of who God is more real to me than the reality before me. So think about it like this. The decisions that we make today are going to have ramifications in tomorrow. And then combine it with this definition of faith, that faith is the assurance of things hoped for, the conviction of things unseen. Faith is the assurance in the now, in this moment, the decisions I'm making right now, the thoughts I'm having right now. Faith is the assurance right now of things that I will one day see. Faith is the conviction right now of the things that I will one day see. I got those mixed up. The assurance of things hoped for now and the conviction of things yet to be seen. This is what faith is actually about. I am trusting today. I am making decisions today that I know will have ramifications in my future. I might not see the payoff immediately, but I will see the payoff one day. That's what faith is all about. I am choosing in the now to make a really difficult decision, a decision where I don't see all the tangibles, I don't see all the solutions, but I know that I know that I know that God is going to be faithful to who he is. And on the flip side of this, it might be 10, 20, 30 years from now. It might be once I get to heaven that this thing will be fulfilled because it's a promise of God. So in Hebrews chapter 11, it's pretty cool. Hebrews 11 starts off by defining what faith is in verse 1. And then in verse 6, he goes on to say that without faith, it's impossible to please God. So the manner in which you and I can please God, it's not by our works. It's not by our church attendance or our tithing records or whether we helped an old lady across the street. Those things are good, but the way that we can please God, the only way for us to please God, is to trust in those things that God has promised, those things hoped for, and have assurance, conviction of those things that we have not yet seen. And so this is what Hebrews 11 is all about. And then sprinkled in that, between the definition and this phrase of it's impossible to please God, are all these biblical characters, these Old Testament characters who are in the Hall of Fame of Faith. They're listed for their faith. They're listed because at some point in their life, in their story, they made a decision, an immediate decision, that would have ramifications years and years later. So when things were looking down, when the whole world was screaming one thing, they were looking at God, at what was true, rather than what is just real, and saying, I trust I trust what I know to be true. I trust what God has said. I know who God is. I know his character, and I trust him more than I trust this situation in front of me. So it lists all these characters. We've looked at two of them already in this series. We started by looking at the story of Noah, which is not a happy story. It's not this cute little story where parents paint murals on their children's nursery. No, it's the biggest mass genocide of all times. But in it, what was happening was God was telling Noah, I'm going to flood the earth, and I want you to build this boat. I want you to build this ark, and then I am going to flood the earth. And so Noah hears this, and it takes like 70 years. It takes decades before God finally floods the earth. And during this time, he's being ridiculed. He's being mocked. His faith is being questioned. He has to be doubting whether he heard God's voice during all of this. But ultimately, it's paid off by God rescuing him and his family for the faith that he had at the beginning when things weren't necessarily guaranteed outside of the promise of God. Then we looked the following week at the story of Cain and Abel, where Cain and Abel both served God with a sacrifice. Cain's was rejected because he did not give of his first. He gave of his surplus, but Abel's was received because he trusted God enough with the decision at the beginning that even though I can't see how the provision is going to come, where Cain saw the provision already and he took from his surplus, Abel's like, I know you've promised that you will take care of me, and before that surplus comes, I'm going to give you my first. So we looked at that through the story of Cain and Noah. Now today, this is cool. Today we flip to a character that probably everybody is well aware of, the character of Moses. When you think about the Old Testament biblical heroes, like who's on the Mount Rushmore of Old Testament heroes? Moses certainly makes the list, right? You've got Abraham has to be on there, the father of faith. You've got Moses, and you've got David. I think those three are like shoo-ins. They're like guaranteed. The fourth might be a little bit of a controversy. Is it Joshua? Is it Solomon? Is it Ruth? I would vote for Ruth because I believe Ruth is just a really important piece of the Old Testament, kind of defines things a little bit differently, and I would vote for Ruth. But Moses is there, and Moses is a really interesting character because in Hebrews chapter 11, he makes the Hall of Fame of faith. Listen to what it says in Hebrews 11, 23. It says, by faith, Moses, when he was born, was hidden for 3 months by his parents, because they saw that the child was beautiful. Now, beautiful doesn't mean that he's just this good-looking child. They saw something special in him. They saw a blessing. They saw God's hand or God's specific fingerprint on him, that God was going to do something with him. So they saw that the child was beautiful, and they were not afraid of the king's edict. Now, I think most of us have read this verse before and gone, okay, this is the story of Moses, and it goes on to talk about Moses as an adult. It jumps from him as a baby to him as an adult and talks about his faith. But verse 23 is not about Moses' faith at all. It's about Moses' parents' faith. And we find in Exodus chapter 2, we find the story that's playing out. We'll walk through this in a minute. But this is the story about Amram and Jochebed. These are his parents. Amram is his dad. Jochebed is his mom. And this story is really about the story of their faith and what they trusted God with. It's one of the most craziest stories in all of the Bible. If you've watched The Prince of Egypt, which is circa 1997, I can't believe it's that old, 21-year-old movie, but this kind of fleshes it out for us. It takes some Hollywood liberties, but it's a pretty interesting movie. But let me read this story to you so you can kind of get a picture and try to put yourself here. Put yourself in Moses' parents' shoes as this whole scenario takes place. Exodus chapter 2, verses 1 through 10. Now a man from the house of Levi went and took as his wife a Levite woman. So this is Amram and Jochebed. The woman conceived and bore a son. And when she saw that he was a fine child or a beautiful child, a child of purpose, she hid him for 3 months. When she could hide him no longer, she took for him a basket made of bulrushes and daubed it with bitumen and pitch. She put the child in it and placed it among the reeds by the riverbank. And his sister, this is Miriam, his sister stood at a distance to know what would be done to him. Now, the daughter of Pharaoh came down to bathe at the river, while her young women walked beside the river. She saw the basket among the reeds and sent her servant woman, and she took it. When she opened it, she saw the child, and behold, the baby was crying. She took pity on him, and she said, "This is one of the Hebrew's children." Then his sister said to Pharaoh's daughter, "Shall I go and call a nurse from the Hebrew women to nurse the child for you?" And Pharaoh's daughter said to her, "Go." So the girl went and called the child's mother. And Pharaoh's daughter said to her, "Take this child away and nurse him for me, and I will give you your wages." So the woman took the child and nursed him. When the child grew older, She brought him to Pharaoh's daughter, and he became her son. She named him Moses because she said, I drew him out of the water. And we need to go back. In order for the story of Moses to make sense, we need to rewind all the way back to Abraham, the father of the Jewish nation, which ultimately leads to Moses liberating the people of Israel. So it's really important. In order to understand this story, we got to go all the way back to Abraham. So in the beginning of Genesis, we're introduced to Abraham. Near the beginning of Genesis, we're introduced to Abraham. And God comes to Abraham and basically commends Abraham for his faith. He declares Abraham righteous, not because of his works, not because of what he did, not because of what he hasn't done, but because he's had faith. And because of your faith, he's declaring you righteous. And also, he says to Abraham, he makes this covenant promise to Abraham that I'm going to make a great nation out of you. It's the nation we now know as Israel. And this nation, there's going to be so many descendants that it's going to outnumber the stars in the sky. And this promise happens, and then we don't see this promise fulfilled for years and years, decades and decades later. So Abraham has this decision of faith in God at the very beginning, but he doesn't see it come to pass for a long time. But this entire time, he is holding on to that promise. He's maintaining his faith with God. He has the assurance of things hoped for, the conviction of things unseen. This goes all the way back to Abraham. So Abraham has a son, Isaac. Isaac has a son, Jacob. Jacob has a son, Joseph. So four generations have passed. Joseph, the great-grandson of Abraham, is unliked by his other brothers. Jacob's other sons don't like Joseph. And I'm making a really long story very short. And so they take their brother, and ultimately they sell him into slavery. Joseph is sold into slavery, and through a series of crazy events, just as crazy as this Moses stuff, through a series of events, he ends up in Pharaoh's house, and he's a prisoner. He's been accused of crimes he has not committed, and he is in the prison of the most influential and powerful man on the planet at this time. So God starts working some things, and God does some amazing things in him, where ultimately Joseph is raised to be the number two in all of Egypt. God just keeps elevating him, keeps promoting him, until he is now basically the vice pharaoh of Egypt. So he's Pharaoh's number two guy. And he's interpreted a dream for Pharaoh, letting him know, warning him that a drought is coming. Prepare for this drought. So during this drought, Egypt is prepared. They have food, they have water, they have everything that they need to sustain them during this entire drought. During that period of time, Joseph's brothers, who are estranged from him, don't know what's happened to him, don't identify him, they come back to ask for help from Egypt, from Pharaoh. Joseph serves them. Joseph ultimately reveals who he is to them. And Joseph's brothers go back, get Jacob and their entire family, move them to Egypt to rescue them from starvation during this drought. So at this point, the Jewish nation, the Israel nation, it's just one family. It's Abraham's descendants. It's Abraham's grandkids and Abraham's great-grandkids. And they all moved to Egypt to preserve their life. So through God doing this crazy thing in Joseph's life, raising him from prisoner to authority, all of a sudden the nation of Israel has been saved. So the faith of Abraham is already being panned out in this. But what happens next is really crazy, because all of a sudden the story turns where there's a new pharaoh. Generations have gone by and there's a new pharaoh. And the new pharaoh doesn't remember Joseph. He doesn't know the story of Joseph. He doesn't know how Joseph saved them. What he sees when he looks out the back window of his palace is he sees that the Jews are multiplying. So the Jews are getting more and more and more. And he ultimately takes them from invited guest in Egypt and he enslaves them. And so for 400 years, the Egyptians enslave the Jewish people, and the Jewish people are servants to Pharaoh and his kingdom. So they were start off as guests, they're now slaves. And now 400 years later, we now find the story of Moses, where Moses would ultimately lead these people out of bondage. But what happens first is Pharaoh is looking out his back window. He's seeing all of these Jews, and they're multiplying to the point where there are more Jews than there are actual Egyptians. So the slaves at any time could form a coup, and in this coup overthrow the Egyptians and overrun the Egyptians. So he orders this edict that for any midwives helping out with Jewish mothers who are pregnant, if any Jewish mother gives birth to a baby boy, they are to kill that baby on the spot. Now think about that. Think about how tense that would be. If you're a parent, if you're Moses' parents, if you're Amram and Jacobed, or Jacobed, what are you wishing for when you're pregnant with this baby? Number one, you're probably praying that it's a baby girl, so her life would be spared. Number two, you're making plans for what to do if the baby is a boy. What am I going to do? How am I going to avoid this death thing? Or how am I going to prepare my heart so I can have it happen? And when the baby's born, of course, we know the end of the story. The baby's born, it is a boy. And what we saw here in Exodus chapter 2 is that Moses' parents, their act of faith, the one that gets them into the Hall of Fame of Faith in Hebrews chapter 11, their act of faith is to actually hide baby Moses. Of course, his name isn't Moses at the time. We don't know what his Jewish name is. Moses is actually his Egyptian name. The plans that they had for this baby, what they did was they hid him. Now, during this time, imagine how tense this had to be. Number one, they're just praying that their baby boy, their newborn baby, doesn't do what every other baby does and pitch a fit. They're praying that he's not going to cry, because if he cries, they're going to be caught. They're also praying that those around them in their inner circle don't turn them in, because if they turn them in, they're in trouble. And then they also have this knowledge, this understanding that if they get caught, it's not just Moses' life that's going to be killed or murdered. It's their whole family. For the anarchy they've risen against Pharaoh. So they've put their lives in danger. They've put their other children in danger. This is an incredible leap of faith for them. And so those months, those 3 months, those must have been some sleepless nights, some anxious-filled nights. Even though they didn't fear the king, they were having incredible faith in God, doing what they felt God was telling them to do. So this story, think about this. This story is not necessarily about Moses' faith. This is about the faith of his parents. So these 3 months pass by, and all of a sudden they can no longer hide Moses. It's just impossible. Maybe word's about to get out. Maybe he's just becoming too rambunctious. He's like the only boy of that age. And so people are like, how did you get away with this? Word's going to spread, and ultimately they're all going to die if they're caught. So they have a decision to make. What are we going to do? And you can see mom and dad maybe having plans over dinner. Just, hey, what are we going to do with this kid? What options do we have? And the option that they came up with is an option that none of us would have thought of. It's the craziest option. Exodus chapter 2 shows us what they do. Their decision is, hey, you know what we're going to do? We're going to make a basket. Now stick with me. We're going to make a basket, and we're going to kind of tar this basket so water can't seep into it, and we're going to put some bulrushes in this basket to make it comfortable. And you ready for this? This is the kicker. We're going to put our baby in this basket. We're going to put a lid on said basket, and we're going to put it in the river. Now, this isn't just any river. This is the Nile River. So the Nile River is filled with crocodiles and hippopotamuses and rhinoceroses. For those of us that have been on safaris in Africa, those are not waters you want to tread lightly into. And they're putting their newborn baby in a basket and putting him in the river. And I'm like, hey, what's your plan once you put him in the river? Like, what are you hoping for? And Amram and Jacobed are probably like, yeah, that's all I got. We're going to put him in the water, and that's it. Maybe he will float down the river and go past Pharaoh's kingdom, and somebody else upriver will find him, and he'll be okay. But if we keep him here, it's certain death for him and for us. This is the best option we have. Think about that for a minute. As a parent, as a person, when your options are so limited, are so narrowed down that your best decision is the worst decision. You can't imagine having to make a decision like this. But this is the decision they make, and they send their baby boy down the Nile River. And if in case it wasn't already bad enough, it took a turn for worse in that the person that found baby Moses was none other than Pharaoh's daughter. So the enemy finds him. Think about this. If you put it in context, think about this during the Holocaust, where maybe a Jewish mom and dad were trying to save their baby, and this baby ended up in the hands of Hitler's daughter. And what's your thinking at this point? Say, God, what are you doing? This is a child of promise. This is a child of destiny. This is a child that has his stamp, his mark, your mark on him. Why Pharaoh of all? And you're looking at it going, I had faith. I trusted you. I trusted what was true over necessarily what was real. I trusted you. And the worst possible scenario to them is taking place. But what they don't know is what God is doing behind the scenes. So my question for us today is, have you ever been there? For yourself, have you ever been there? Have you ever had to make a really difficult decision that you knew was the right one, but once you made that decision, all of a sudden the world came crashing in and you never anticipated that this kind of suffering was possible. And now all of a sudden you're looking at God, you're going, what the heck? This isn't necessarily what I thought it was going to be. This isn't how I saw it playing out. I thought it was going to be all roses and peaches, and I thought it was going to be cool. But God, I trusted you, and it's not playing out the way I thought it would, and this suffering is coming in place. Now, let me ask you this. In those moments, when you've had faith in God and things aren't playing out the way that you thought they would, are you ever tempted to start making decisions that don't really involve faith, but they're more short-term, they're more impulsive, they more speak to your immediate than your long-term scenario? Because faith is saying yes to something that might not pay off for a long time. But our culture, and this isn't just a millennial thing, this is all generations right now. Our culture, we have been redefined to be so impatient, in such a hurry, that we want things now. And if we don't see the result we thought we were going to get right now, then we might shake our fist at God. We might question God. We might doubt God. Faith is nowhere to be found in those moments. So we fall prey to temptation. We fall prey to those things that can feed us now and we won't have to wait for a long time, right? So do we do that? Do we fall into debt? Do we fall into a consumerism mentality? Do we give up on our marriage because it's not playing out the way that we want? Do we start looking at porn? Do we give into the addictions and the alcohol, the drugs, the things that can temporarily relieve us, and we give up on the long-term plan? So for Amram and Jochebed, this has to be an insane thing. I'm having faith in you now, and God, I'm not seeing it play out because he's going into the hands of the enemy. He's not just going into anybody's hands. He is in the hands of our enemy. Now, can you see what God's doing here? Of course we can, because we know how it plays out. But for his parents, this must have been so difficult. It can't make much sense to them. They're like, God, why are you allowing this to happen to your people? Number one, we're slaves, God, to this wicked king, and you put us here. Remember, Joseph, you put us here. What are you doing? And why my baby? Why did you take this innocent little baby? Why did you allow this to happen? What's the story that you're telling? Because it doesn't make sense. Imagine you raising this kid, and all of a sudden he goes to the enemy, and you want to shake your fist. You see, the suffering was immediate, the suffering was real, and the suffering was deep. But we know, because we know the rest of the story, the long-term payoff was huge, because behind the scenes, God was doing something that maybe Amram and Jochebed had no clue was going on. That ultimately, God was going to raise up Moses to be the leader that redeems his people from this slavery. But they don't see it right now. They just see their baby going into the hands of the wrong person. So think about this in terms of Amram and Jochebed's incredible faith, where Moses' parents were protecting the life of their child for 3 months with the threat of losing everything. You know what God saw? God saw faith. Where Moses' parents saw sacrifice when they put their son in a basket, you know what God saw? God saw worship. Where man saw Moses living it up in the palace, because imagine this, Melanie and I were talking about this just the other day. Imagine being his parents and seeing your child grow up in the enemy's palace. He's eating well. He's being educated well. He's got the best of everything. So part of you is delighted because he's not living the life of a slave. But part of you is really just struggling with this because that's your son. That's not her son. That's not Pharaoh's true grandson. That's my boy. And he's not where he belongs, even though he's getting the best of everything. So they got to be conflicted. Yes, he's safe and he's provided for, but this is not who he is. So where man saw Moses living it up in the palace, you know what God saw? God saw a commander getting to know his enemy from the inside. Without this knowledge, who knows what Moses could have done or what he'd been handicapped in. God had a plan. God was equipping Moses in the moment that it seemed like all hell was breaking loose, as though God had forgotten them. The very thing God was doing was providing for them. Where man saw Moses receiving the world's greatest education, God saw an opportunity to adequately train Moses for the job that he had in store for him. The bottom line is that you and I are called to trust God in the immediate, in the right now, even though the short-term result might not be pleasant, so that he can do something not only in the situation, but in you. And look how the story plays out. The faith of Amram and Jochebed obviously grew as they watched God work in their boy. The faith of Moses' sister, Miriam, and we see this in her song she would later sing, grew up as she walked by faith through this. The faith of Moses' brother, Aaron, grew to a point where he would eventually help Moses lead. And you know who else's faith grew in all this? Moses's. You see, Moses would grow up in the house of the king. He would grow up in the house of Pharaoh. And he would see all these things, and he'd see all these privileges, and he'd see all these things take place. But the faith that his parents had was somehow passed on to Moses, even though he didn't know who his parents were. He hadn't hung out with them. They hadn't taught him. But God had blessed Moses with this generational blessing that because your parents believed, Moses, you too will believe. And I believe there's a spiritual principle here that's really at play. Parents, what do you want your kids to be like? What do you want your kids? Do you want them to trust God? Well, if you want them to have faith in God, can I just shout out to you? You've got to set the pace. You've got to demonstrate. You've got to have faith. Your life cannot be all about just protecting them and making sure little Johnny doesn't get a boo-boo or an owie. It must be describing and demonstrating faith and courage to them if you want them to have a life of faith and courage in God. So as parents, we want to protect our kids from evil and harm. We want to teach them in the ways of Jesus. We want to pray for their salvation. We want to launch them into God's path. And we have to trust God to take care of them. I want to suggest to you that it's worth the risk. The souls of your children demand that you have faith in God for them now, in the immediate. When things aren't going right, you don't shake your fist at God. You trust God because you want your kids to trust God. You show them what faith looks like. Pay the price of faith now so you can experience the blessing of the eventually one day. Now, listen to how Hebrews finishes up with the story of Moses. It goes from the faith of his parents to jumping to when Moses is an adult. Verse 24, by faith now, Moses, when he was grown up, he refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to be mistreated with the people of God than enjoy the fleeting pleasures of sin. That's interesting. He considered the reproach of Christ greater wealth of the than the treasures of Egypt. He considered the reproach of Christ. This is an Old Testament story. But yet what the author of Hebrews is demonstrating is that Christ was active in the Old Testament. And this is pointing to the story of Christ, where Christ himself would leave the comfort and the relationship and the beauty of heaven with his heavenly Father to identify with those of us who were enslaved to sin so that ultimately he could rescue us from sin. Now, the story is different because Moses was trapped in a wicked kingdom where Jesus was in paradise with his heavenly Father. But he identified with us so much that he left the throne of heaven, the comforts of heaven, because he had sympathy for us, because he had concern for God's glory, because he had concern for our redemption, that he became one of us. So he considered the reproach of Christ greater wealth than the treasures of Egypt, for he was looking to the reward. By faith, Moses left Egypt, not being afraid of the anger of the king, for he endured as seeing him who is invisible. By faith, Moses kept the Passover and sprinkled the blood so that the destroyer of the firstborn might not touch them. See, as Moses grew up, he grew up as the grandson of Pharaoh, the daughter of Pharaoh's daughter, or the son of Pharaoh's daughter. And somehow, one day, he realized, man, these aren't my people. I don't know what it is. Maybe he realized their accent was different. Maybe he looked a little bit differently. Maybe he liked different things. Maybe a bully at the schoolyard was telling him, you know, you're adopted, right? And he goes home. He's like, Mommy, am I adopted? And all of a sudden, the truth comes out. But Moses identifies more with the slave than he does the comforts of the kingdom. And this is amazing. This is the faith of Moses. And so Moses would then, he would ultimately lead the insurrection or the insubordination of Pharaoh in the exodus of the Jewish people from Egyptian slavery. And he would do this. And think about what he was leaving. When he did this, there was short-term suffering in his faith. He was going to alienate his adoptive family, the family that could have killed him, but instead raised him as their own. He already been alienated from his biological family, and when they see him coming, none of them receive him as a hero. He's going to lose his position in the kingdom. He's going to lose his power. He's going to lose his finances. He's going to lose his home. And he's now going to identify with slaves instead of as a prince. This is incredible. This is the faith of Moses. Short term makes a decision that's going to impact and not come to fulfillment for years and years. As a matter of fact, for Moses, he only leads the people out of Egyptian slavery. He does not get to lead them into the promised land. That would be Joshua's job. But God put him in this place through the faith of his parents, put him in this position where he could identify the weaknesses of his enemy, and then ultimately demanded Moses have his own faith, not his parents' faith, but the faith of his own, that would allow him to lead God's people out of slavery. This is what Jesus did. This is what Jesus did for you, and this is what Jesus did for me. Jesus left the comfort of heaven so that he could identify with a slave and lead us out of our slavery to sin and lead us into freedom. So my question for all of us as I wrap this up, just sitting here in my office, my question for us today is this thought of, hey, our faith sometimes, it's shaken because we don't see God come through immediately, because we don't see what he's doing. It's confusing. We might shake our fist at him. God, this is not how I thought it would be. Your promise said this, and I don't see that coming to fulfillment. And God's like, I'm not done with you yet. And kind of what we do, because we're a consumeristic, impulsive culture and generation, is once we got used to things being microwaved, we're like, we no longer have time for the slow cooker. We no longer have time for the oven or the grill to warm up and to heat this thing slowly. We want to microwave it. And when we microwave it, we lose all the nutrients. It doesn't taste as good. It might come to us quicker, but we're never going to get the promise fulfilled. And what God is doing right now is he's slowly cooking things in our lives. And during that slow cook process, he's asking you and me, are you willing to still trust me? Do you only trust me when there's this emotional high at the beginning because you think it's going to play out a certain way? Or are you going to commit to me and say, God, come hell or high water, I will hold on to you. And what he does is like Romans chapter 5 when he says, you know, suffering produces perseverance, perseverance, character, character produces hope, right? When we do this, when we wait on the Lord, when we have faith at the front and the promise doesn't happen, come to fruition for a long time, or at least maybe even until heaven, God is developing a faith in us that is real and strong and not fake just to get our own way. You see, what faith is, where we want it short term and we want him to give into our impulses right away, is really, it's us just trying to manipulate God to get our own way. And what God is doing when he slow cooks something, he's like, I'm going to get my way and I'm going to develop your character into my character, and it's going to be real faith. It's not going to be faith where you're just trying to get me to be your genie, but I'm going to be your God and I'm going to take care of you, and my promises are true. My promises are yes and amen. I will come through for you. But faith demands that you're in this for the long run, that you cook this thing, that you slow cook this thing, that you don't microwave it. And the slow cook tastes better. The slow cook has the nutrients in it that you need. The slow cook has everything in it to make you more like Christ. So my prayer for you is that you would have the faith that is long-term and not short-sighted. God bless you.
If you're not already a part of Orlando North, please know that we'd love to have you come visit us on Sunday morning at 10:30 for our weekly worship service. We're located at 1021 Douglas Avenue in Altamont Springs, Florida. Come as you are and be welcomed by a church that is eager to connect with you. For more information about our church, you can check us out on the web at orlandonorth.com.